Welcome to the Archives of the Loralee Show, conversation for exploration. Timeless discussions to challenge and expand our worldview. And while you may find our guests fascinating, the views expressed may not necessarily reflect those of our own or of the Cuyamangue Institute. That's why we call it Conversation for Exploration. And join in our ongoing live events, interviews, our own presentations, and much, much more as we go exploring. Learn more at CuyamangueInstitute.com and Loralee.com. And hello there, I'm Loralee, and thanks for tuning into Conversation for Exploration. Thank you for tuning in. We got our homework done for the night. Now we're going to have some fun. Sean Cahill's an anthropologist, and he spent several years in Australia. His mission was to learn the sign language of the Aborigines, but he learned much, much more there, and he's here to share with us his adventures. Welcome, Sean.
Hi. I went out to Australia in 1960. I was just 30 years old with a brand new PhD, and since I'd been working on my thesis right up until time to climb on the plane, I knew nothing about the Aborigines, really nothing. So I spent about 3 months. January 1960 was the middle of summer, and Sydney was paradise. And so I went to the beaches, and I went to the library, lived with a Ukrainian family, and ate lamb and mutton every day, three meals a day. And study.
For breakfast too, huh?
Oh, yeah. I really like mutton. And gradually began to learn a little bit about Aborigines the way the previous anthropologists had seen them and reported them.
Oh, from some book learning, reading the writings of earlier anthropologists.
Some book learning. And it was very casual, relaxed book learning because I wasn't doing it for a class or for a thesis or anything like that.
You're just interested in it.
Yeah, I was just getting background. And I also talked to my colleagues, and one of them was Mervyn Maggott, who had written a book called Desert People about the Wildberry Aborigines in Central Australia. And he said, okay, if you take all the people in the world and you put them in two categories, you would have the Aborigines in one and everybody else in the other. They are that different.
That different.
And if you forget that, you're going to miss the boat. So when you go out there, just understand that you have a lot to learn.
And your entire lifetime did not prepare you. Nothing in your lifetime prepared you for that.
This is really true.
So what did you do? And you went out there with the purpose of learning the sign language. Was that an academic assignment? Was it something you decided? It was.
Yeah. I had a National Science Foundation grant from America to not to learn the sign language. See, we professional anthropologists to study it and to analyze it and to report on it.
Okay.
And the reason,
big difference, actually.
And the reason for this is that the National Science Foundation is a sort of a subsidiary of the United States government run by the academic community. And their idea was that someday we're going to meet somebody in space.
Oh, I love it.
And we're going to need to communicate with them. And they might not happen to speak. I mean, they might not have a vocal language, a language based on sound. And everything we had previously known about the structure of language had come from analyzing spoken languages. And sure, there are lots of different kinds of spoken languages around the world, but it's still the same kind of language. Mm-hmm. So they had the idea that if someone would come up with an equivalent kind of analysis of sign language, a gestural language using hands and face and body, maybe that would give us a different perspective on what language, unquote, could be.
Okay, you were there to look at the essence, the bare bones, the dynamics of a language that was not vocal, but by movement, by body language, by...
But from the perspective of someone who had trained as a spoken language linguist, which I had done. I was an anthropologist. My minor was in linguistics.
Okay.
And I had also learned a language well. I learned Russian in the Army Language School. So I had some feel for what spoken languages were like. And I learned enough French and German for my graduate proficiency exams, and I'd learned Spanish as a kid and all like that. And when I got to the sign language, it was American Indian first. I did that for my PhD. That was part of my graduate.
Which American Indian was it?
A whole bunch. I did a survey.
Oh, a survey of that.
And I'm one of these very lucky people that as late as the 60s, I got to do surveys on two continents. Most anthropologists have been problem-oriented with a particular group, and they devote half their life to very narrow studies. And I was in the same boat as the 19th century anthropologists who got out to go and cruise around and have a lot of fun with a lot of different people and get a sense of a lot of different people, which is a very wonderful thing. It's not very disciplined.
I would assume that there's a real value in that because the more you have to compare and contrast, the more data you have to look at the field as a whole, the more you're going to look at basic patterns, basic dynamics. What do all these things have in common in terms of their very essences? So it seems to me a very valuable approach.
It humanizes
approach.
It. It's not quite as scientific as the formal scientists would like, but it's much more human.
And I would assume that that's an approach that would be very useful to a study and an encounter with the Aborigines, that human approach. I don't think you could spend time with them and not come back to that in the end.
Yeah, something else I was told in Sydney was that they probably wouldn't tell me much until they'd known me for years and years and years. And because this is the perspective of social anthropologists, and they've been out there asking about their sex lives and their magic and their sorcery and all that stuff. And I didn't, you see. I just asked about their language. They would tell me about their sex lives and about their sorcery and all as linguistic examples.
Oh, how fascinating. Let's learn more about that with anthropologist Sean Cahill. He's got some incredible stories for us. We'll be right back. I'm Laura Lee. Hi, we're back. Laura Lee here on The Laura Lee Show. Our guest, Sean Cahill, has spent a number of years in Australia as an anthropologist, and he's relating his adventures. He started out making a study of the sign language of the Aborigines and learned much, much more. So anyway, how did you make your first contact with your first tribe? Do you just kind of go out and...
Actually, the first contact was at Udnadatta, where the opal mines are. And I'd spent 4 months in Sydney, and then when I was ready to go to the field, I was going to meet a fellow anthropologist from Indiana University, or a fellow linguist. Ken Hale and his wife Sally were working out of Alice Springs. So I drove around through Adelaide and then up the central road from Adelaide, South Australia, towards Alice Springs, and along the way is the opal mine, so I stopped there. And the Romanians are the ones who do the heavy-duty work at the opal mines. They dig down, 100 feet, 160 feet, and chop up the rock and pick out the easy-to-find opals and send the slag heap on up. And then the Aboriginals come, mostly women and young kids, and sit and gossip on the slag heaps and hand-pick over what the Romanians have thrown away. And it takes them about 6 weeks to accumulate 60,000 pounds worth of opals. In those days, that would be about $120 worth.
Right,
so
okay.
So 60,000.
So they can earn quite a good living just by sitting in the sun, gossiping, keeping their hands busy. Okay.
And when they had that much accumulated, then they'd send out word for their husbands, and everyone would troop off to Adelaide and go on a buying spree. And they'd go to the theater, they'd buy fancy clothes and dress up and buy cars and sewing machines and washing machines and you name it.
What did they want to do with all that stuff?
Well, they were just using the money. They were having fun. And then when they get bored with it, they'd drive out towards their home desert again, which was sort of northwest of Adelaide. And they'd get out partway, and they'd run out of gas or oil or something, so they'd leave their vehicles and all their stuff, and then there would be this trail of stuff that they've gradually discarded more and more of, and they'd end up back at the mission or the government settlement or their own home territory with nothing except what they had for 40,000 years before the white man came along. And then they would live that way for a while, and then they'd drift over to the opal mines and
start the cycle all over again.
Gather up some more opals and then go off to Melbourne or Adelaide or Sydney or somewhere and do it all over again. And so these were people who could move back and forth between a very primitive way of life and a very sophisticated use of our way of life.
Now, by sophisticated use of our life, how do you mean that?
Well, everyone I met who'd met Aborigines remarked on how at ease they were in any circumstances. If everyone was wearing tuxedos and the Aborigines were either wearing tuxedos or half naked, they acted like lords of the universe, as though they just belonged there and they had a perfect right to be there. And, no self-consciousness, no embarrassment, no awkwardness about which fork to use. They used the fork that seemed most useful to them, or pick things up with their fingers. They didn't care. And they were very, very good actors and very good mimics. So they could usually figure out how it was appropriate to act from our point of view in any situation instantly. And then they would choose whether to do it that way or to just go on being themselves. It didn't really matter to them which.
This is true centeredness.
Yeah.
This is a lesson for us in the West here. Yeah, true centeredness.
These are people who are comfortable in the universe. They've been living here consciously for a long, long time.
Now, by consciously, you mean?
That they maintain consciousness, waking and sleeping, living and dying as a group through thousands of years. They literally remember all their previous lifetimes. They literally remember, as a group, the interim periods between the lifetimes, which they call dream time. Now, the individual loses his individuality when he dies, and that's something unique to the Aborigines in other cultures.
In terms of their belief system, you mean?
Well, since they're actually remembering, it's hard to talk about it as beliefs.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I see your point. Okay.
It's a little different when you actually remember what you've done.
Mm-hmm.
And in other cultures...
The rest of us just have guesswork to go by, you're
right.
saying. Okay.
When someone dies in another culture, he has a choice of going completely, just drifting off into nothingness, becoming one with the universe, and he as a person or she as a person no longer exists.
Oh, I see.
Or personally being responsible for maintaining some continuity of soul so they can reincarnate. And in many cultures, people do reincarnate. But it takes some effort, and you don't get a full vacation in between if you do that. Whereas with the Aborigines, the group takes responsibility for maintaining the individual's identity for him.
We'll be back with Sean Cahill and Laura Lee. We are back, Laura Lee, here with Sean Cahill, talking about the Australian Aborigines. He spent some firsthand time with them. So, Sean, you're saying that most Aborigines... of the intact cultures, and we must remember that there's
right.
many tribes among the Aborigines, there's many groups, there's also of many fractured groups that are kind of in this no man's land between the other Australian culture, the white culture, and their own culture. And so you're talking about the ones that have maintained a purity of their culture remained intact.
Yes.
And unfortunately, there's fewer and fewer of those groups because there's less land, there's less opportunity, there's less this, there's less that.
And there's less training for
less training.
Available to them.
Mm-hmm.
See, if a young person goes away and works in the white man's culture for a while, right in the middle of his initiation, and then comes back, the initiation's off. They won't continue it. They won't finish teaching what they had to teach because they don't trust them. The stuff they have to teach is brainwashing level kind of psychological competence.
The brainwashing level. Do you want to describe that?
Yeah. These people have mastered psychological techniques for manipulating other people's minds, each other's minds.
In a beneficial sense, in a not so
well,
beneficial sense?
Well, it's beneficial if they're responsible people. And this is the whole point, that when these young kids go off and learn the values of our culture and then come back, they're no longer responsible. The older people don't trust them anymore, so they won't teach them the real stuff.
Because the real stuff could be dangerous
because it could be
if you don't have
really
the responsibility,
yeah.
the wisdom to go with it.
You could become a real black magician kind of person and screw up other people real bad if you're not fully responsible on manipulating these techniques or in wielding these techniques.
I've never really associated Aborigines with magic per se.
Well, we're not talking about magic necessarily. What
you're talking about
talking about
a use of consciousness.
Psychological know-how. how to control each other's minds. See, they practice constantly, as I say, in memory. When we had the station break, I was just about to say that when an Aborigine dies, he gets to go into the dream time totally. They become absorbed in the oneness of the universe. Doesn't have to work to keep his own personality alive in order to reincarnate later, because his tribe does that for him, or his group, his family does that for him. And they practice all their lives remembering people. Someone just goes on a small trip, and they'll set time aside every day to remember that person, to weep over them, to feel the whole emotional impact of their personality, so that later, when that person dies, they will be skilled at remembering them and be able to hold that memory clear for 10, 12, 15 years until it's time to draw the essence back out of the dreamtime oneness and recreate that personality so it can reincarnate as a granddaughter or grandson.
Kind of reminds me of Star Trek, you know, beaming up. You take a person, you put them into an electromagnetic signature, and then you recreate the signature over here, and they get to reappear over there. Same kind of, if we're going to put this purely in a electromagnetic energy term, same kind of idea?
As a matter of fact, it's exactly the same thing as happens in teleportation, except instead of happening instantly or in a matter of seconds, there's a time delay.
Well,
like
it's kind of
years.
Like they've taken that time and spent it here in the void or the dream time. Okay.
And this means that each person who dies gets to really relax, really let go. It doesn't even have a soul, no individual attributes at all, and can really become one with the way the universe is. So that when they are drawn back out of that, they're coming with a tremendous representational state, that they really represent reality. They represent the way the universe is and the way the universe works.
Or, and that must be why the Aboriginal culture is the way it is. It's so close to that then.
Right.
We'll be right back. I'm Laura Lee. Hi, we're back. Laura Lee here with Sean Cahill talking about the Aborigines of Australia. Tell me more about the psychologically brainwashing technique, but finish this. I've never heard this before, that they get to go between lifetimes and really truly absorb and dive into that pool of the dream time of mm-hmm. universal what?
In oneness. Our terms, we would say they become one with God.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they come out, they're really messiahs. Every new reincarnated person is like a messiah.
They've been so close to that.
It's someone who embodies all the attributes of the universe, or of God, as we would say, and takes on a human form, human responsibilities, human way of life.
But they don't have to come back. I mean, they could go to some other planet or some other being or something.
They don't consider that a viable option. To them, it's so precious that they made landfall on this planet, however many.
Why do they think it's so precious?
Because they remember being adrift. Their group spirit being adrift in the universe.
Oh, really?
In blackness.
Uh-huh.
With nothing to do, nothing to see, nothing to hear, no senses, no nothing. And then way off there seeing light and drifting towards it for trillions of years, maybe.
And that's their creation story.
And eventually discovering that was a universe they're approaching. And then coming closer into that and seeing brighter light over there somewhere and drifting towards that for several billion years, maybe. And discovering that that's a galaxy. And eventually getting within the galaxy and then finding there are bright points of light all around, stars. And drifting towards them for hundreds of millions of years. And finally discovering that there are planets and being able to land on a planet. And then, horror of horrors, discovering that they are such an alien life form that they are totally poisonous to the planet and the planet's totally poisonous to them, but that out of the sickness that they cause each other, eventually viable life forms evolve that can live on that planet and have individuality. And at that point, they are Aborigines then.
So you're
some
saying that
hundreds of thousands of years ago, or you know, tens of thousands of years ago. And then they start moving around the planet. And one of the facts of life on this particular planet is the way the ocean currents work, that before you have power boats or tack sailing, when you've just got a raft with a sail stuck up so you blow in front of the wind and drift with the currents, if you leave Southern Asia or Indonesia west of the Sunda Straits, which are between Java and the Celebes, you will land in the Kimberleys in Australia. Doesn't matter where you thought you were going or where you'd like to go. That's where
the current has a mind of its own.
And so everybody who ended up out in the Pacific had to get there through Australia. The people of eastern Indonesia, like New Guinea in that area, the people of Melanesia, the people of Polynesia and Micronesia, maybe even some of the people of the Philippines and Japan, went through Australia to get there.
So what does that mean about the Aborigines?
Are
representational of all of those various cultures,
right?
Part of the myth.
These are people who happened to wander towards the inland instead of sticking to the coast. See, the standard pattern was the people would land in the Kimberleys, which is northwest Australia.
You have to tell me all about this when we come back in just a moment.
South, east, and up the east coast, and then off.
We'll be back. Hi, we're back. I'm Laura Lee, and this is The Laura Lee Show. Thanks for tuning in. Our guest right here is Sean Cahill, anthropologist who spent a number of years in Australia, made quite a study of the Aborigine people, and also learned a lot about their culture. They were telling him much of their stories, I think simply because you didn't ask, Sean, and you had a mind to understand this. The Aborigines, they themselves claim history going back in Australia of about 50,000 years. And you were telling me that it is a cultural melting pot, that the ocean currents made, all ocean currents in the South Pacific lead to Australia.
Let me say it again. Ocean currents take one from eastern Indonesia, like Sumatra, Java, or anywhere in Southeast Asia, and dump them in northwest Australia. So in order to get to eastern Indonesia, like the Celebes or New Guinea or any of the Pacific Islands, the only way you can get there is to go through Australia. So you go by ocean to northwestern Australia, and then you go all the way around the south coast of Australia and up the east coast. There, the currents take you north and east. So you can get out into the islands from Cape York, from north of Cairns, north of Brisbane, Queensland. And so all the people who populated the Pacific Islands came through Australia to get there. And the people who ended up being Australian Aborigines are the ones who didn't keep going around the coast. These are the people
stopped.
Who wandered off into the inland, into the interior desert. Most people didn't do that because the interior desert's devilish hard to live in. But those real hearty souls who really didn't want to stay with the other people who were just walking around the coasts worked out a whole new lifestyle. And these are the people we now call Aborigines, but their ancestry is incredibly mixed. They're people from all over Central and South Asia. And their culture, though, began to form up once they got to the desert, and they evolved something quite different than the peoples who were just moving on out into the islands.
As a way to adapt and live in the desert or learning the lessons the desert had to teach them.
And one of the things they decided to do was to remain conscious, awake, all the time. Waking, sleeping, living, and dying. And they couldn't do this as individuals in the living and dying, so they did it as a group. So the group maintains consciousness for its individuals when the individuals die, and then sucks them back out of the oneness and brings them back into the game, into the theater of incarnate life. To them, the reality is the oneness, being one with God, being one with the universe. That's the dream time, and that's the real reality. But they have a very strong sense of gamesmanship. So when they are incarnate, in Carlos Castaneda's terms, it's a game with heart. Mm-hmm. And they play it with lots of energy and lots of skill and lots of intelligence.
How does that inform their culture, the way that they do things? What's a typical life in the day of an Aborigine What is it that they do that expresses their basic cosmology? How does it show up in their life, their stories?
Let's start in the middle of the night. Someone has a vivid dream. He wakes up and wakes other people up and gathers everyone around, tells them the dream right then while it's hot. And maybe they'll discuss it, maybe they won't. It depends on the kind of dream. They might just say, okay, this needs some brewing. We'll put it back in the subconscious. And everybody lies down and goes instantly to sleep again. Or they might sit up and discuss it till dawn, if it's something that's ready to work with a rational mind. These people always use both rational and intuitive minds in balance. They consider it extremely dangerous to themselves to be going only on intuition. They consider it extremely dangerous to other people and to the environment to work only on the rational mind.
How insightful.
And they think our culture is just absolutely insane. The word for white man all over Australia and is ghost. And the sign is a double-handed claw, which means ghost. Because they just can't believe that we can be living real people. They think we must be dead to behave as irrationally as we do.
Irrationally, we who pride ourselves on the rational approach here to things.
Yeah,
interesting, telling.
They consider it totally irrational to use only reason.
Wonderful paradox.
So they're constantly training themselves and each other, and they're constantly practicing using their skills.
We'll be back with Sean Cahill. I'm Laura Lee. We're back. Laura Lee here on The Laura Lee Show. Our guest is Sean Cahill. We're talking about the Australian Aborigine. You know, it's interesting how this message, look to your intuition, the answers are here. If we just listen to them, there's still a quiet voice inside. Is there, pay attention. The message is getting put out from so many different sources, in so many different ways, in so many different forms of expression. I find that rather extraordinary. It seems to be the message of our day. Reconnect with God, or however you want to understand it, in your own way. You and He, you know, you and the universe. That's the main connection point here that we need to reestablish these days. Fascinating, isn't it? I guess the Aborigines ought to be pleased here.
The Baha'i Prophet Baha'u'llah in 1860 prophesied that by 1975, that we would be on a real downward curve on this planet in air pollution, soil pollution, water pollution, warfare between women and men, warfare between cultures, warfare between age groups, that all the graphs would be going right off the paper, that it looked like we were going to destroy our planet and destroy our environment, and that we would evolve to the point where we could solve all these problems with our minds, and that the only reason we would evolve at that rate of speed would be because we had to.
Another of necessity.
It takes work. It you can't do it. It's a lazy thing. So sure, we're getting the message. We're getting the message from Jewish mysticism. We're getting the message from every side.
Because we have to, right?
I've just finished reading a book by David Rosenbaum called The Tzaddik. Tzaddik means a person of great mystical ability, a master. And he's following in the tradition of Chaim Potok, who has written a whole bunch of books about Jewish mysticism, about the Hasidim. The Hasidim are the mystic branch of Judaism. They originated with a very turned-on man 200 years ago in Poland and the Ukraine and Hungary and in that area, and they had each generation had a very highly evolved rebbe or rabbi teacher, who not only knew the wisdom, he'd studied the Torah and studied the Talmud, knew all the Jewish wisdom, but had direct access to his own superconscious, so that he could know what was going on in the world. One guy was supposed to be able to see across the world. And see through time, so he could see into the future, into the past, whatever, and just knew what was going on. Others had what's called clairsentience. They had the ability to know the truth without having to see it or hear it. Some people have clairaudience. They hear it, but that requires interpretation to get the truth. Some people have visions, clairvoyance. Again, it requires interpretation of what you see to get to the truth. Clairsentience is in some way a purer gift because you just know it straight. You know the truth. You don't have to fiddle around with interpreting. But all these abilities are things that the Aborigines have been systematically researching and training each other to do for 40, 50,000 years. And they remember. That's the big thing that the Aborigines do that most other cultures in the world don't do. Maybe the Tibetans do, where you have this line of lamas that are the same person reincarnated over and over again.
The rest of us have amnesia, so we have to start right back on square one.
Yeah, we pretend we have amnesia. We think it's, oh my God, thank God I'm going to die, then I can let this life go and get a fresh start. No, the Aborigines say everything you learn in life is supposed to be used in life. It's not supposed to be used in heaven. You don't need that stuff in heaven. You don't need the skills you learn in life in the dream time. In the dream time, you're just becoming one with all of it, becoming assimilated to the whole reality. But when you learn stuff in your incarnate life, that stuff you're going to need to use in incarnate life. So you need to remember everything you've learned in every lifetime and put it to practice as you go along.
So it sounds like God set it up perfectly here.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's we in the West who don't know the rules of the game to live it out well and to sport the gamesmanship and play the game as comfortably.
And we don't want to know.
Why?
Because it's hard work.
It's hard work. Oh, I see.
It's real hard work. The responsibility
is lazy.
Awesome.
Uh-huh. What do the Aborigines have to say about that?
Well, what they have to say about it is you play the game with heart as long as it's fun. And when it's not, you hang yourself up in a tree or walk off into the desert and die. When you can't cut the mustard anymore, then you need a rest. You need a vacation. You need to become one with reality again.
Of course, they would die without fear then.
So you do that, and your culture maintains your personality for you. So once you've had a good rest, you can come back in and pick up your responsibilities again.
Oh, how interesting.
But, of course, as you said before, I'm talking about a very small percentage of the surviving Aborigines. For most of them, the young people went off to work in the white man's culture, came back to the tribe and said, okay, I'm sorry. I'm sorry I left in the middle of my initiation. I'm back. Continue, please. And the old men say, well, we're terribly sorry, but we don't trust you anymore. Because you've imbued yourself with a whole bunch of white man's values, and you know how crazy they are. So, yeah, I discovered how crazy they are.
We'll be back. Hi, we're back talking with Sean Cahill about Australia and the Aborigines. You've been mentioning initiation. Were there any kids left to initiate once they go off? And the elders would warn them, I suspect, but they're like any teenagers. They want to go off and explore what seems cool. What is the initiatory process? What are they being initiated into?
Okay, they're being initiated into self-discipline, and then the skills that someone who has self-discipline has the right to wield.
Got it.
The analogy they made to me was that you wouldn't put a four-year-old child in the seat of a Boeing 707 and have him try to pilot it. You know, you'd kill all the passengers. This would be very dangerous. So they feel that way about their lore, about their psychological and mm-hmm. philosophical lore, that the concepts that they are, that the fully initiated are masters of, are potentially very dangerous. They can be used as sorcery. Or they can be used for education, and the difference is responsibility and self-discipline. So a lot of what the actual process of initiation is learning self-discipline. For instance, young guys who are in the initiation compound are not allowed to scratch themselves. Well, hey, this is the tropics, right? We're in the jungle. There are lots of little biting insects and stuff. You can't scratch yourself. Can't touch your own body. Can't use hot food. Can't eat cooked food. Not allowed to sleep very much. So you're being put into a state of high stress in order to create the dissociation that makes for rapid learning. See, in the normal evolution of a child, he's in a state of total dissociation right after birth. I mean, he's come out of the womb, he's in a different environment, high stress situation, so he learns rapidly, learns language in a year and all like that, right? Then kids go through another state at puberty where the chemistry, the hormones, everything is changing. So again, high stress, open to great learning. This is it. And traditionally in our culture, we have things like the English public school, or to put it in a more familiar context in America, West Point or Paris Island Marine training, where people are put under high stress so they can learn military skills that they'll be able to fall back on during stress in combat. Rapid automatic reactions that will enable the group and the individual to survive. So every culture knows about this, knows that dissociation leads to learning and stress leads to dissociation. So the Aborigines' traditional initiation is just another version of that. They put these kids under high stress. They're not allowed to talk. They have to use sign language and not very much of that. And they have to obey. And they're put in very rigorous physical conditions. It's sort of like the Indian Vision Quest, but that's only for a few days, whereas this goes on for years, and not enough sleep, not enough food, not enough protection from cold or heat, and they just have to learn how to survive that and to thrive under it and to learn what they need to learn in it.
Gets their attention. It's not the taboos themselves that are meaningful. It's the fact that the condition of stress and therefore high state of learning open to that. We'll continue with Sean Cahill. On the other side, I'm Laura Lee. And we're back. Hi, Laura Lee here. I'm enjoying my conversation with Sean Cahill. I'm sure you are as well. He's the anthropologist, spent a lot of time in Australia among the Aborigines, learned a lot about their culture, heard many of their stories. He's sharing them with us. And quite an in-depth understanding we're gaining. Sean, thank you for cutting to the bone and giving the bare essences of, it's just really making it so clear and succinct, describing the dynamics of the Aborigines, their thinking, their psychology, what makes the culture up. I'm learning quite a lot. You were just describing initiation of the ed that the elders teach to their young people, putting them in a situation of stress, years of which creates in them a ability, a necessity, you're saying, to learn, to develop that sixth sense in order to survive, to develop that self-discipline, to develop self-responsibility with which to wield this responsibility. And it's all happening on a psychological level. This is where all battles seem to be fought at some level, is within our own psyche.
And also to remember the enormous bits of information that they need to live in that environment.
Tell me about that.
See, the Aborigines don't generalize very much. They believe that any simplification is oversimplification, that it's necessary to know everything you've ever experienced in all your lifetimes put together. It's necessary to know every star in the sky individually, not by constellations, but individually. Each star has its own name. To know every bush in your home territory, not just the general contours of the land, but each bush, each rock, each individual insect. They get up in the morning and they look at the camp area, and there's tracks all around the camp area. There have been bugs crawling around and little mice run across and snakes crawl across. They look at the tracks and they can name you the particular insect or the particular snake or the particular bird that hopped there.
That's almost beyond our comprehension.
They can tell you its sex. They can tell you its age. They can tell you whether it was injured, whether it was hungry, everything about it.
And that's all left in the peculiarities of its tracks. I'll spit it out.
And that's really? All. Yeah, that stuff is learned under great stress. To learn amount of information, you have to be in a state of dissociation. So you have to be able to go into a state of dissociation whenever new material is available to you.
So they walk through altered states like you and I would walk through doorways.
That's right.
I've heard it put from.
And you have to in order to develop the kind of memory that they have. Mm-hmm. And everything depends on the memory. I mean, I'm talking about people who literally remember everything they have ever done for 40 or 50,000 years.
I've heard that the only memory aids that they have are in their sacred caves that each tribe keeps, a sacred space, like a temple, and that there would be maybe paintings of significant events in their history in an ongoing, like an ongoing page, but that their memories were prodigious and that they distrusted book learning because thought, well, get out of practice memorizing. You can get lazy because it's all written down for you. It doesn't have to be written in your memory.
One day when I was doing my anthropology work, I was writing along and I'd ask some questions about language. And one old man said, oh, wait a minute, I told you that 3 weeks ago. And I said, oh, yeah, I know. It's written down back there. He's, tell me again. It's easier than looking back. No, he says, let's see how long it takes you to find it when you look back. So I had to rustle through all my notes. And he's just sitting there tapping his fingers. And it took
teaching you a little lesson.
Yeah, it took me a long time. He says, well, that's it. So you got it all on paper, but you don't have it in your mind. We don't use paper so that it will be in our minds. And it's important to have all the data in your minds if you're going to make correct plans and draw correct conclusions from your life experience. It's not enough just to have representative samples. You need it all.
Okay.
We need it all.
And so in the sense that then their prodigious memories would then include all this data of their personal history, the collective history, the collective present, their individual. So again, they're going to the max with the rational mind. It seems they also go to the max with the intuitive mind. Mm-hmm. And they're known for their telepathy, say. So they've developed their sixth sense to communicate one to the other, to maybe look at that track and maybe even get a sense of the bird that walked there,
right,
not just from the track, but maybe the morphic resonance that's left behind or something like that. We'll be back. Hi, we're back. I'm Laura Lee, and this is The Laura Lee Show. Thanks for tuning in. Our guest right here is Sean Cahill.
There's a very strong primitive physical presence about them that works hand in glove with this exceedingly great psychological and intellectual sophistication.
I have this theory that the more that's contained within the mind in terms of the landscape that we see in the universe around us and the world around us, our immediate environment, the more richly painted that is, the more data we pull in, the more experience we immerse ourselves in from that, the simpler the lifestyle can be. And that we who make our lifestyles very, very complicated, mm-hmm. it's because our aperture for experience and taking it all in is so close, so we have to complicate it. That's my personal theory. Yeah. What do you think, Sean?
I don't know. I was at an ethnomusicology conference once and met Alan Lomax, and he'd been doing a thing called Cantometrics, where he's doing a statistical study of the relationship between complexity in music and complexity in the culture. And he said, all around the world, it seems to work the way you'd expect it to, except the Australian Aborigines, because they, on the surface, appear to have an extremely simple culture, but the most complicated music in the world. How can this be?
And let's talk about that in just a moment. Yeah. Get your response. I'm Laura Lee. Hi, Laura Lee here with Sean Cahill, our anthropologist. So, Sean, you were saying that this musicologist was noting that the more complex a music of a culture is, the more complex the culture. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it's usually a one-to-one relationship.
Except for the Aborigines,
it was the
opposite kind of relation, an inverse.
Looked like they had a very simple culture. But it's not simple in their minds, you see. Their environment is exceedingly dense. I mean, we think of them, here's these lonely people way out in the desert with nothing around them. But to them, who have names for every little hummock, every rock, every tree, every bush, it's a very dense environment. It's a real jungle of named forms and beings with whom they relate constantly every day, all day.
A rich tapestry. And what was your response to this musicologist?
I told him that.
Oh, I see. That was your response.
And he said, oh, I'm glad I met you. I understand it now because it hadn't made any sense to me before.
I would think the same would be true for our own indigenous population, the Native Americans, whose music is maybe simple but exceedingly beautiful.
Yeah, it's very beautiful. It certainly doesn't have the rhythmic and textural complexity.
It has so much soul. Extemporization of song. Can you demonstrate a little bit? I know that you sing.
Oh yeah. Now, that's an example of a typical Aboriginal song, and it's done with syllables that sound like Aboriginal language just the way they do. They sing all kinds of songs, both sacred and secular, that the words sound like Australian Aboriginal real words, but they don't mean anything. They just make them up as they go along. They change the syllables. Maybe a long time ago, they were derived from words that did mean something. But they get so into the creation of the music and the poetry and the rhythm of the syllables that they get beyond that.
A didgeridoo, I want to explain to our listeners who may not be familiar with the term, is an instrument that's made by defining a existing hollowed-out log, hollowed out by termites. And so I'm told that an Aborigine comes along, when they decide they want to play music, they'll pick up and make whatever instruments from rocks or stones or leaves or whatever they want. And a very common one is that hollowed out log, which are highly priced. And then when they were done playing music, they set it down to be picked up by the next music maker, right?
Well, that's what they do in the Western Desert, where the area that I did my field work in Arnhem Land, they keep them around. They bury them in the mud so the sun won't crack them.
Oh, I see. That would make sense, of course.
Or leave them in the shade, you know.
And they can blow on them, and they're like a long,
yeah, it's a simple hollow
flute.
Yeah.
And they can make sounds of kangaroos, of wailing, of all sorts of drum beat. I mean, they can get amazing sounds out of it. I've had a didgeridoo player on the show.
It's a real drone sound with a lot of rhythm.
That's what it sounds like. Well, he's doing this without one.
And so on and so forth. Let's get back to, you were asking me, how do they put this telepathy thing together?
Well, here's the thought here. You're saying they max out the right brain, and I'm told that even in the Middle Ages, people had wonderful memories. They could memorize everything in laws of court, people would be brought in, and they could remember other people's through generations, details, and these kinds of things, and they relied on memory. Memory was reliable. Even the old Celtic bards could remember the lines to, you know, 1,000-line poems, no problem. Mm-hmm. So it seems to me that they were also...
Not no problem. You have to work at it.
Well, it was possible. It was done.
Constant practice. That's what...
It's a good point. It wasn't easy, but they were doing it. So here, the Aborigines are noted for their ability to have telepathy.
Yeah.
What is it like?
I started to say a typical scene in the Aborigines' life is that you are sitting around, a bunch of people are sitting around, maybe eating, maybe singing, and a guy gets up and he wanders off. Now, maybe he's just going into the bush to relieve himself. But, say 10 or 15 minutes go by and he hasn't come back yet. Then his wife will stand up, gather up her dilly bag, and follow him.
What's a dilly bag? Just a,
yeah, just a
collection
little,
of stuff. Yeah.
A purse. And you don't know whether they're going to be back next week or 3 years from now. They've just...
Did they know themselves?
Yeah, they've walked away. And so someone who has done that from another area comes into camp next morning. Okay, you see them in the distance. When they're within shouting distance, you start hollering out to them, "Oh, hi, so-and-so. I see you've been to so-and-so place, and I see that you caught some kangaroos the other day, and you're fat and sassy," and on. You'll be telling the other person about their trip.
And you're just picking that up through.
And the other person, as he comes in, he's shouting, oh, I see such and such has happened since I was here last.
Oh, we're talking about the Australian Aborigine. You're saying that two Aborigines will meet, not having known where the other one was. They'll just cross paths. And the one will begin telling the other where he's been, what his adventures are. And he knows this by a combination of being a Sherlock Holmes, who's looking at the minute detail of the way the person's walking, how fresh they are, how tired they are, this and the other. He's surmising, or he's getting it off the airwaves, something. They themselves don't know, you said.
Right. I can't tell. They can't really tell because they always use both.
Okay.
They always use intuition and they always use rational deduction.
No separation between
them. So they don't separate between them. They wouldn't think of telepathy as a thing in itself. Telepathy is just one of the things they use to know the world.
Well, I guess, you know, when we're inputting data, we don't say, I'm feeling this, I'm seeing this. It's just all one experience, inputting data into making up our experience, right? So if you had add a sixth sense to that five senses, it would be the same thing. It all blends together.
Right, and it does.
Okay.
And when it's all together, it makes sense.
Uh-huh.
You have a feeling of rightness about it. You know that one.
Right.
And it's not something you could stop and pick apart. If you pick it apart, it doesn't make sense anymore.
I see.
So it's only when it's working holistically that it works.
Making good sense.
Yeah. Let me say something else about the context where all this is going on. This Australian bush is dangerous. This is a very, very rigorous environment. The snakes are so poisonous that you don't have time for an antidote. A brown snake or a taipan, if he strikes you, you're instantly dead. It's a nerve paralysis thing. It paralyzes your whole nervous system. And these scorpions are about like American or Mexican scorpions. The centipedes are 10 times as poisonous as a Mexican scorpion. If you're on the coasts, you're walking around the barrier reef, you step on a stonefish. It's deadly poisons jagged
barbs.
Spines and barbs. Or you step on a punch shell. It takes a circular cut out of your tendons and your meat that is just too large to heal, so you'll die of gangrene.
A punch shell? What is this?
It's like a barnacle, but it's real sharp-edged shell, and you step right down on it, and it just punches out the sole of your foot.
Oh. Or a jellyfish, right?
Well, the jellyfish is just an annoyance.
Uh-huh.
These other things are really deadly. Trapdoor spiders that you know, the poison is as severe as a black widow, but they're huge. They're great big spiders with lots of that poison, and so on and so forth. So you're living in an environment where you can't make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Eskimos don't even bother to learn to swim, because if you tip over your kayak in water that cold, you're a goner. So if you make any serious mistakes at all in the Australian outback, you're a goner. You've got to be able to find the water. You've got to be able to go across the desert, and if one water hole happens to be polluted, that's foul because animals have died in it or something, you have to be able to suck water through a straw.
A reed.
Out of a sandbank. You have to be able to gather the dew in the morning.
You made some real good points that I want our listeners who may not have heard us to hear. Sean, you were saying that the deserts of Australia, where the Aborigines make their home, is a very arduous environment. A lot of poisonous centipedes and snakes and spiders and stonefish if you're walking along the coast. I mean, there's danger at every turn, and you can't make mistakes or you're a goner. You're also mentioning the water holes are few and far between, and you can't be tempted to drink out of a poisoned water hole. And if you're stuck, you have to be able to ascertain where water may be by punching reeds through the sand and sipping out some sandy water. I mean, you've got to be a survivor even to be there. So you are relying upon that fully equipped and ready and alert, rational and intuitive mind, the two blending together to give you all of this information. And that you also made the point that even they themselves don't know what input is coming from the subconscious, the psyche, the telepathy, the paranormal, or what have you, and what is coming from the rational mind. They're so well blended
together. Yeah, they never use one or the other. They always use them all.
Yeah, so it's one experience.
You've got to use them all.
Seems to me, at last, I kept wondering, you know, why are we so relying here in the West on our rational mind and so dependent in an almost pathological way and not paying so little attention to, you know, this other gift that we have, this intuitive mind and the sixth sense? Why are we so distrustful of it? You have some comments in that, which we'll get to. But in explaining the arduous environment, there's no getting lazy. There's no shutting off there. Can continue.
Well, for instance, your food supply. It's mostly in the dry season. It's food that's dug out of the desert. See, during the wet season, during the monsoon, everything grows like crazy, and plants reach their maturity very rapidly, and then the water doesn't come anymore, and it starts drying out, and these very lush plants shrink down to tiny little wisps of vines. And you've got to be able to see. You have to have sharp eyes. You have to be able to see these vines and know from a little bit of dried up stem what's under the ground, whether it's worth digging or not, because the job of digging is very hard. The women use 5-foot-long iron bark crowbars, they call them.
Iron bark is very stiff, hard wood.
It's a very hard wood. Mm-hmm. And these things are as heavy as iron. And they dig in the ground 5-6 feet down, maybe in a circumference of 3 feet or 3.5 feet, and there's a root down there that's the size of a man's thigh or whole leg or as big around as a beach ball. And 95% of these roots are deadly poison. They got prussic acid and cyanide and God knows what in them. And so they have to be leached. You got to grind them up and pour cold water through and then cook them and pour hot water through and throw this away and throw that part away and then do something else to it and let it sit for 3 weeks and ferment and then some other process. And you have to know exactly which leaching process to apply to each particular thing. It's all got to be timed right. The amount, the mass of information you need to survive in that environment is just staggering. And these people are very
like
sharp,
an infant, yeah.
The ones that survive. And probably that's the reason they're very sharp, because they are the ones who survived. The people who really couldn't cut the mustard didn't get to have children.
Oh, apply a little Darwin here.
Yeah, we're playing
survival of the
some
fittest.
Very heavy Darwin here.
Fittest means the most information, the most able to make use of the data available.
And the balanced use of your brain, so that you are using everything together.
As a survival technique, okay.
And
it may become a survival technique here in the West as well, as we need to add some wisdom here to and that full complement of brain attributes.
Yeah, and what does wisdom mean?
Left and
wisdom
right.
Is not just the two halves of the brain, but it's the two halves of the brain working in balance also with the heart.
With the heart, yeah.
See, the carrier wave is the emotion, whether it's telepathy or good judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And wisdom is the proper balance of your feelings and your intuition and your knowledge and your intention. And that's the other element we haven't talked about, your intention. What are you here for? There's a purpose in life. There are many purposes in life. And the Aborigines develop their purpose lifetime after lifetime after lifetime. They take on responsibilities that take generations, thousands of years to fulfill.
Like what? What would be such a responsibility?
Like keeping track of the evolution of the planet and assisting it with their ceremonies. That keeping track of the creation and assisting it with their ceremonies. Now, this is one. Listen to this carefully, because I'm going to say something that at first is going to walk right by you, but it's real important. Creation is circular. The beings who went walkabout in the dream time, now I'm using dream time in a different sense now, in an ancient time, and created the land, created the water holes, created the kangaroos and the cockatoos and all these creatures, were not gods in the sense that we would understand in our religion.
In a mythological sense, as we understand.
Yeah, it's more like the Welsh mythology, where these people were enhanced human beings. But where did the enhancement come from? The enhancement came from their descendants, who properly did the ceremonies commemorating and sending energy by that commemoration to the original creators.
Okay, so you're saying time flows backward as well as forward.
Yeah, and the energy from the for the creation is provided by all the succeeding generations remembering and valuing and being grateful for the creation.
So it is a loop. It's
so
connected.
So it's a real loop. My granddaddy couldn't have done it without my help, sort of thing.
And you're not going to be able to do it without future help.
Right.
Let's the contemplate
continuity
that
continuity down through the ages is so important. It's
cross-connected here.
It's very cross-connected. Way. It's like the Kabbalah. It's like the Jewish Kabbalah, where your tree of life works from bottom to top and top to bottom.
I see. Two-way street.
Yeah.
But then also you're saying that there is an understanding of time as being all one in the dream time. There is no past, present, future as we would know. It would be a different experience. Contemplate that as we take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Sean Cahill. I'm Laura Lee. We are back. Laura Lee here with Sean Cahill. Sean, so you've explained something that I've been wondering about for a long, long time, which is when I read about ancient cultures and mythology, why mankind was so careful in other cultures, not our own, to propitiate the gods, to honor the gods, to keep them present, to pay attention to them. You're saying because the gods needed them in order to be gods, would
right.
be your answer according to this
right.
Aboriginal point of view. So what happens to society today? Because we're no longer doing that.
We may be exactly what the Aborigines call us, ghosts. Our whole culture may be a kind of robotic ghost. We're just carrying on with a new momentum, entropy, but running down if the living heart isn't still in us. And I don't think that's the case. I think the living heart is still in us. I think it's reviving. I know that in Australia there are more young people who are going through initiation now than two generations ago when I was over there. That there has been a revival of interest. There's been an understanding on the parts of the young people of how shallow our culture is and how important it is to get their full initiation before they risk getting contaminated by our culture.
A similar revival of cultures going on among the Native Americans,
yes,
and I would say among our youth.
And among the Celts
in our
culture.
Of course, yeah.
There's this huge Celtic revival here in the Northwest.
And I would say that everyone is kind of searching to be reconnected. They say that interest in spirituality is up. People may not be attending Orthodox religion so much. I know they've closed 12 churches in some city or archdiocese or something, but people's interest in spirituality is on the upswing.
They've probably opened 112 in Russia for everyone that they've closed here.
That's true. They've been denied that for so long.
Yeah, when I was over in Russia, I went to the cathedrals. They were full. Every service, they were full. Young people, old people.
Because they can finally worship out in the open now.
And the feeling in those cathedrals, like I've never encountered that kind of feeling in a church in the West. Like true spirituality. These people really know that they've got something good going. I attended a wedding preparation class. My American friends were getting remarried in the Russian Orthodox Church. And they had to become Russian Orthodox for this to happen. So I went to the one of the instruction classes for them. And the priest said, you know, you get a grace with Russian Orthodox that you don't with any of the other Christian sects. That is that your sins are actually taken from you. That the Lord will look the other way about your sinful thoughts. And he said, everyone has sinful thoughts. That's why we set our religion up this way. The mind should be free to think anything. A human mind should be free to entertain any thought, no matter how evil. But you shouldn't have to burn in hell for that. And so in our religion, you get automatic dispensation, automatic grace for your thoughts. You know, if you put your thoughts into action, that's another matter. You're responsible to the civil authorities and to the higher authorities, but not for what you think.
Interesting.
In Russian Orthodox, you're really, really relieved of that.
Well, that excuses Jimmy Carter. Tell me a little bit more about this revival of spirituality among the Aborigines. The elders must be so pleased and so thankful that there's somebody to pass their culture on to.
I would assume. Look, I haven't been there since 1964.
Right. What about the telepathy? Did you experience a little bit of increase in that? I mean, I've also heard that...
No.
The carrier wave. Tell me about the carrier wave and the emotion on it.
Look, not while I was there. I didn't think so. But when I got back to Sydney, and people would ask me questions, when I got back to America later on, and people would ask me questions, I would find this stuff coming out of my mouth. I thought, whoa, wait a minute.
Where'd this come from?
Did you actually see the evidence for that, or are you making that up because it seems as though it ought to be true? And at the time, I judged myself rather harshly. I thought that perhaps in some cases I was making it all very logical instead of making it all fit. But then I came back to America and got into some heavy-duty spiritual practices, and in meditation I finally did remember seeing the evidence for some of the stuff I'd been saying. I remembered hearing things that I'd been so busy with my camera and my tape recorder and writing down notes
mm-hmm.
that a lot just went in one ear and out the other, but it didn't really go out the other. It was in there.
It sank in. Uh-huh.
And it took like 10, 15, 20 years for me to be able to recall some of this evidence that I had actually seen and heard. And that in fact, none of the important things that I'd been telling people about the Aborigines were unfounded. All of them were based upon evidence that I really had experienced, but with some level that wasn't at the top of my consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
So, is that telepathy?
It's a silly word. You know, it's for...
Yeah,
I mean, you're describing it really nicely, saying... It's not a separate thing. It's just all part of the functioning.
Yeah, it's part of what a mind does.
And that carrier wave.
We are connected, and the carrier wave is the heart, or the emotions. You know, the power of emotion is what information rides on.
How do we put all of this into our own life to enrich our life, to expand our view of humanity, of, you know, how do we conclude? This has been a wonderful tour. I've learned so much that I hadn't known.
It's a matter of opening to it, you know. When I was in Australia, I didn't think I could ever sing the way they sang. I didn't think I could master this. I didn't even try. I didn't try to learn the singing stuff. I didn't try to learn the techniques. The reason it seemed so strange to me and so difficult was because they were extemporizing, of course. And so they weren't repeating the same thing, the same way, enough for me to feel that it was accessible.
Oh, we look for patterns, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And for 30-some years, that's the way I viewed it all. And I did learn to play the didgeridoo, and I learned to dance, but I never learned to sing. And then this spring, I was doing some toning as part of biodynamic gardening, Rudolf Steiner's stuff.
Oh.
And I was at the zoo, and I was toning outside the wallaroo cage and the emus, and they weren't paying any attention to me. And then it shifted, and it started coming out like Aboriginal songs. And I didn't do this deliberately, it just started sounding like that to me. And darn if the wallaroos that were out there didn't jump up and run over to the fence, hop, and just sit up and pay attention to me.
Those are kangaroos, wallaroos?
Wallaroos, yeah. They're big black kangaroo family. And There were 10 more of them inside the glass cage, and they came running out and hopping. They all lined up and listened to me. And then I went back to toning the way I'd been doing before, and they all lost interest, started hopping away and browsing. So I switched back to the Aboriginal-like stuff, and they came right back again and paid attention. So I thought, whoa, what's going on here? These are kangaroo-type people who have never been in Australia. They were born in San Diego Zoo or Atlanta Zoo or Seattle Zoo, and generations here. So there must be something in the DNA that's coming through. And where is it coming from in me? It must be something that's soaked into some deep layer of me when I was sort of subconsciously listening to them, but fiddling with my tape recorder and writing down notes and stuff. Something must have gotten by my guard and gotten in there, and now it's coming back out again. Also, I began thinking, the Aborigine that I worked with a lot in Australia with music died in 1982.
And
maybe he's helping me now. Maybe he's been into the dream time. He's partway back out, and his ghost is coming and teaching me, because he used to call me nephew, and that's the way it works. The mother's brother teaches the nephew the new stuff. And someone like a songman will stay out of incarnation for an extra 10 or 15 years to do that.
Interesting.
So maybe I'm getting some help.
May you live in interesting times,
and
Laura Lee.
May you guys get some help from them and us.
Laura Lee Online. www.lauralee.com